Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to this special live edition of the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from that storied bastion of pretension and culture and learning, the bookworm in Beijing. I am Kaiser Guo, joined here by the prodigal son, Jeremy Goldcorn, implacable enemy of the people, and yet dear friend to me, the man behind Danway.com, who by great good fortune happens to be back this week in his familiar stomping grounds here in Old Chokey. For those of you who haven't been following the plot, Jeremy moved from Beijing back in February to follow his lovely wife, Wu Fei, a very talented musician, to Nashville, Tennessee. And this is his first time back in Beijing, the longest time he's been away in 20 years. Jeremy, greet the people of Beijing in that genteel Tennessee accent.
I can't do it yet, but hello, Beijing.
Oh, boy. Yes.
I should say hi, y'all.
Hi, y'all.
We're also joined by David Moser, whose wisdom, his erudition, his musical virtuosity have been inspiring petty resentment accruing in me now across the many years I've had the pleasure of knowing him. David is, of course, academic director of the CET program here in Beijing, most of whom are present tonight. Look, oh my God, Moserlicious. He's got the fan club. Your song is upside down, dear. Have you talked?
My students are a little challenged. They read too much Chinese. It sort of screws up their brains.
Okay, great to see you, man. Great to see you. And we would have been joined by the absurdly tall Eric Abramson, the king of Beijing translation nerds. But apparently he was physically assaulted by Chinese literary dissidents who were enraged by his insistence in a recent New York Times editorial that Chinese literary dissidents don't actually exist. He's given us his express permission to mock him ruthlessly during this event. And so, guys, let us not squander this rare opportunity.
Well, he's too tall.
That's his main fault. So we're here actually today as of course, part of the 10th anniversary of the Bookworm. So happy birthday again. Actually, I don't believe that the decade that we're celebrating the Bookworm here includes the several years that it was over, about 400 meters from here, where Taikuli Village now stands, where it was combined with this French and Moroccan restaurant called Le Petit Gourmand. Anyone remember that? Anyway, the Bookworm, as you all know, has been the gathering place for many frustrated and angsty novelists and screenwriters who you can find here during the day because they don't work, hunched over their Macs, and cursing, lamenting the fact that it's no longer a smoking environment. It's been host to many published writers, unlike these guys. It's also to an impressive lineup of speakers who've addressed a variety of topics, to some great to not so great stand-up and improv, and it's even been host, I've heard, to an occasional quiz show, which is something we hope to do again. So today we're actually going to go riff on a few of the different things that the Bookworm's 10th anniversary brings to mind. The very learned talks from the great speakers that they bring, and the weighty and stimulating conversations that one so often has, just with friends and acquaintances, people that one meets here in this storied place. Also the fact that these conversations mostly involve foreign residents in Beijing, and not just that, but ones who tend to come from the developed world, in a kind of parallel conversation. That's really too often quite disconnected from the discourse about this city, this country, and these times that the Beijingers themselves have been having. So we'll talk about the last decade here in Beijing and about the defining characteristics of the place here, which I think we would all agree the defining characteristic is change. Not smog, but change. And we'll talk about other facets of life in this frenetic, frustrating, funny, fucked up, and fabulous place. At the risk of prattling on too long, I wanted to actually set the stage here for our conversation by reading a little section from something I wrote almost 10 years ago to the day. It's an appropriate kind of thing. In a column that I used to write for the Beijinger magazine, the column was called Ich bin ein Beijinger. I don't know if you guys remember that. And for the October 2005 issue, I wrote one called The Lifers. And let's have The Lifers sort of be the theme of tonight. Jeremy, you were telling me as we were kind of walking along, kind of not very straight last night. Not very straight line last night.
What are you referring to?
You were telling me that you had always thought of yourself as one, thought of yourself as a lifer, now you've moved. David, you're kind of a lifer, huh? No.
I'm still alive, at least.
No, but
it's like the old joke. You know, have you lived here all your life? Not yet. Yeah, that's kind of the way I look at it.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm actually going to be leaving after 20 years here, although I plan on, you know, living the kind of they call it now, I'm going to the Bay Area, the BEI area, the Greater Bay Area.
Bay area.
That's what we call it now, the Bay Area. So, audience, show of hands, how many of you out here would regard yourselves as a lifer or aspire to be a lifer in Beijing? All right, one brave soul.
There's two, three.
All right. We got three lifers here.
Coincidentally, it's one of my students. I think I brainwashed him or something.
You've done a good job. Anyway, I mean, by the oddest coincidence, when I was preparing for this session on Sunday morning, I suddenly got a WeChat message from an old friend of mine named Xiaonan, who sent me a link to a book that named me as an author, and it was apparently a collection I'd completely forgotten about that somebody had translated some essays of mine, and it happened to be actually the one that was included in that compendium was The Lifers, and I figured that was, I mean, I gave it another read again, and I found that it was kind of apt to what we were talking about today, and I took this very much as a sign from on high. So while I read this, I want you to think about whether what I wrote then remains perhaps true today, so here goes. Expatriates settle here for a wide variety of reasons. They're moved here by multinationals expanding their China operations, or they're following their own entrepreneurial impulses. They come to learn the language. They recognize the growing importance of it. They come to teach their own native language, recognizing a growing interest in it in China. They're drawn by a sense of the historical moment, or to the cultural and intellectual ferment of Beijing. In the not too distant past, you encountered people, you know, fairly regularly who came to China in search of a kind of timelessness, of some mystic Eastern spiritual wisdom. You would occasionally cross paths with a dyed-in-the-wool leftist ideologue with a badly, frankly, outdated grasp on China's political-economic realities. But these types, thankfully, typically met with disillusionment, and they either got wise or they shoved off. And they're very, I'm grateful to say, they're quite rare today. Most people come to China now because they are drawn by change. They come because these are interesting times. They don't all stay. When you've lived in Beijing for a while, you start to see what qualities separate the sojourners who spend a few years here tops and then move on, separated from those hardcore types, the contingent that knows deep down that Beijing is home. These are the lifers, and because change is the one fundamental constant in contemporary Beijing, how the lifers deal with change is perhaps the critical element in how it is that they manage to stay on, to stay sane. Most lifers have stopped getting mad at the fact that Beijingers want their city to be modern. They've come to grips with the fact that in a city of, this states it, 15 million, not everyone is going to be able to live in a courtyard home on a quaint hutong. Privately, they have their moments of nostalgia shared with other lifers about the hardships they endured in earlier times before hypermarts and Starbucks and Jenny Lou's. They'll reminisce occasionally about the times when they felt like they knew virtually every expatriate in town, but they deal. They accept that Beijing's no longer that small town they once knew. They reach out to the people new to town, they make new friends, and they don't stick cliquishly to other lifers. They also know the limits of their own Chineseness, the limits of their own ability to change, to effect change. Insular expats who don't really manage to form real friendships with Chinese people and who don't make a real effort to learn the language tend not to last too long. That's obvious enough. But there are opposite numbers, and we've seen these people before. Those foreigners, so anxious to go native that they abjure any contact with other foreigners, they usually don't last either. These are the types who use the word laowai with derision, as in, it's a laowai party. Meisa, wouqiu. They miss out on the fact that part of what makes Beijing such an attractive place to live is that it is such an international city. At some point, they realize that no matter how good their language skills, they're not, and they never will be, fully accepted as Chinese. They feel betrayed, and then they leave. This is true of foreign-born Chinese, even of Haigui, of returnees, who've been away from China long enough. For the most part, the lifers are done whining, but they're far from done with criticism. Their years in this country have lent them a perspective that newcomers generally don't have. That perspective gives them a sense both for how far China has already come, and just as importantly, for the sacrifices that have been made, at times unnecessarily, at the altar of change. They're rooted enough to feel a stake in improving the community. They know the issues, and just as importantly, they know the boundaries of their effective criticism. Perhaps most critically, the lifers keep a sense of humor about the place with all its essential weirdness. The weirdness is a byproduct of change, and they find merely amusing what others might regard as utterly, contemptible. They're not inured to the point that they don't even notice. They're just sympathetic with the awkward phases that the city is going through. And they forgive the vulgar missteps of the nouveau riche. The better lifers, and I would certainly not count myself among them, do so without a trace of condescension. That's the real trick. Expatriates in China, Westerners in particular, once saw themselves as agents of change. Think back to the missionaries of the 19th century or the revolutionaries of the 20th. Nowadays, few who come here have that hubris. Change in today's China is an exothermic reaction, generated internally. Foreigners, for the most part, are along for the ride. Unlike expatriates, Chinese people who've lived through this era of massive transformation, they've not had a choice. It's either roll with the changes or be bowled over. So yeah, I think that, David, do you think that this still kind of rings essentially true?
Yeah, I think, yes, it does. There's nothing that I could add to that's changed in the last 10 years. I would say that having been here a long time and seeing, some of these very, very few lifers, I almost invited one tonight, and Matt Roberts has been here almost as long as I have. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out what we have in common. And, one of the things would be this sort of buzz that you get by living here, because it is an environment of constant change, constant stimulation. I used to joke as the one word answer to why I've been here so long, I sort of tell people it's my drug of choice. Yeah. Because it is a kind of a high, especially when you first come here, you're learning Chinese, the stimulation, if that's what you want, then China has it in spades, especially when in the early days. But other than that, I don't know. There's a lot of things that lifers tend to have, or expats that stay a long time tend to have. Part of it, I think, is a kind of a love-hate relationship with your own culture, or at least a strong desire to try to understand your own culture and culture itself by being in this very different culture.
It's the abusive spouse thing, right? You don't know Beijing when he's not smoggy.
Well, Kaiser, I think that it's sort of a platonic ideal of a lifer that you've got there, that, I think that some lifers are these wonderful people you've described, and, a bunch of them are assholes. There's a lot of lifers that are, like, really bitter and hate living here, but just have to because they're kind of stuck.
Well, a lot of them are escaping something, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Criminal charges back home.
They've got criminal pedophilia charges back home.
How many of you audience criminal charges?
So, I mean, yeah, that's a nice essay. It's well written. I like it. But I don't think it describes everybody who's a lifer in Beijing. Or, you know,
I don't think it purports to. But I have a question for you, though, Jeremy. Was it something about you or something about Beijing that you think it was that made it possible for you to live in Beijing for as long as you did and to come to call it home as you very much did?
Well, both. I mean, I like Beijing, so it's a kind of a, you know, it's Beijing and it's me. I mean, what I like, why I thought I was a lifer was, I think, similar to, you know, David's idea of a drug of choice. It's just an incredibly stimulating place. And, I mean, you know, I went to Nashville in February, and I didn't really miss Beijing. The last year in Beijing, I was kind of very stressed for various reasons. And I was one of these people who, you know, somebody would elbow me getting into the elevator, and I was this close from exploding, you know. Some one day I went out of my apartment building, and there was a human poop in front of my apartment door, like the front door of the apartment building, and it's sort of Chaoyang Park West Gate. It's kind of their all fancy apartments.
I did that.
Oh, it was you. And I found myself enraged. I'm like, what the fuck? You know, I've been in Beijing 20 years. Everybody, all my neighbors have Lamborghinis. Why is there human poop?
Some of the people who drive Lamborghinis are human poop.
I would dare say most of the people who drive Lamborghinis. So I gotta say, I mean, one of the things that I absolutely love about living in Beijing is just the intellectual energy of the place. I mean, how any of us can head out on any night of the week to a dozen different watering holes and end up just engaged in a fascinating conversation with somebody who's doing really interesting work here. Who has really, you know, valuable perspectives, who says insightful things. I mean, there's a kind of douchebag filter at work here, which I think is kind of wonderful. It just sort of sends a lot of people a packing very quickly. So it turns out that so many people that I do end up meeting here are really engaged in China. They're knowledgeable about China's history and China's culture, and therefore develop a real sense of empathy for the place and its condition. So what do you attribute this to? What is so different from some of China's other cities that shall not go mention?
Well, it's quite an unpleasant place to live, really, I think, Beijing. I mean, it's not a nice... You don't come here for the lifestyle, do you? I mean, would anyone come here for the lifestyle? I don't think so. I mean, food, yeah, you know, of people, but, I mean, it's kind of big and too many people and traffic jams and dirty and polluted. And so if you choose to live in Beijing for any length of time, you're not doing it because it's not Boulder, Colorado, you know, it's not Hawaii. You don't, you know, I was in Hawaii recently and I realized that most of the people who live in Hawaii are either kind of, you know, rich people with no ambition or poor people with no ambition. And it's sort of because, like, why would you have any ambition? You can go surfing every day and the weather's perfect. And
you
there's,
you
know,
need a house. How you just sleep on the beach.
How is that not an ambition? That is my ambition.
Yeah, so you're going to have to become one of the rich people with no ambition. Otherwise, you'll have to, you know, drive Uber or something. But Beijing is not that. I mean, you don't come here because it's pleasant.
Beijing is the center of the Chinese world. There's something about being here that won't let you forget where you are. It's not like, it forces you to keep your mind on where you are and keep focused on why you're here. Whereas when I feel like I'm in Shanghai, I can almost immediately forget why I'm here.
Shanghai does not insistently remind you that you are in
China and what kind of a country China is.
Right. Beijing will never...
Shanghai is where you were Tom Cruise jumped from building to building in Mission Impossible. You know, so you might as well be in a movie. That's the way I look at it. Whereas in Beijing, you're sort of in a... You're maybe in a movie, but it's a dystopian... You know,
no, but I mean, I need
Blade Runner. Have you seen that thing, the Blade Runner? I mean, there's part they show pictures that look like they're a scene from Blade Runner, like the tower in the Olympic
Pangu,
with you know some like beautiful model there, and it's just completely smoggy and everything, and it's Blade Runner. It's absolutely out of Blade Runner. Why did I get off on that? Anyway,
I want to talk about these parallel conversations, these separate conversations that are happening on the one hand by foreigners living in Beijing, often in English, and on the other, the conversations in Chinese by Beijing's own intelligentsia. Chinese are definitely reading the discourse, our discourse about them, but do we read what they're saying? Are we reading, you know, Xue Yintong or Li Daohui? Is this disconnect a problem? I mean, how do we engage in the Chinese conversation better?
You know, you should ask Jeremy this because he's been in Nashville. He's been in the U.S. recently. You know, do you feel that disconnect between what Americans know about China versus what even the average Chinese?
I'm talking about us. I mean, people in this room, the non-Chinese people in this room anyway, who are very engaged, very interested.
Oh, you're saying that the expats here are also
right
on the other side of a wall.
I've studiedly avoided the use of the word expat because I find it to be a highly problematic word, and I'll get that into that in a bit. But 10 years ago, I wrote that essay and used it without any kind of, you know, reflection, and now I believe that the word expatriate, expat, is an inherently racist word that you do not describe. Yeah.
Well, let's just talk about that now then.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, okay. All right, let's go on. That sounds like a good idea. Yeah, so yeah, I mean, what do you think of this word?
So what do these expats think about that word?
No, I mean, I say, you know, throw it on the lexical rubbish heap. It just no longer has place. I mean, why should it only describe people who are you know, not living in their country of birth and happen to be fucking white?
Yeah, well, I mean, my problem is from the very first time I heard that word, I kind of picture like a overweight, pink or red-faced kind of 60-year-old guy in Thailand with an 18-year-old girl on his arm. That's kind of when I hear particularly the contraction,
that's
expat,
my ambition.
That's what I kind of picture. And, I do also think, I mean, in Hitler's memorable phrase, you know, as a half-Jew, I'm a rootless cosmopolitan. I mean, I'm not out of my country. I'm just in Beijing.
But no, Kaiser's point is the fact that it seems to refer only to Europeans and American whites. We don't normally say someone from Cameroon is an expat.
Right.
Usually. Right.
What are they?
They're yeah.
Immigrants.
Not in this country.
it's a little bit like that thing, a map that I forwarded on Twitter, where it says, you know, the Western consensus, and it's Europe and America. That's the West, right? And it's like expats
and
sort of like
and
that.
New Zealand.
And New Zealand.
Canada. Australia. Yeah.
Australia has 15 people. They're not...
a small country.
So, show of hands. I mean, are we all ready to forswear the use of the word expat? Yeah, all right.
Politically correct.
The two lifers.
Like the word gypsy, it's now in the ethnic garbage pail, right?
That's right. Okay. That's right.
I don't know if the audience is convinced, Kaiser.
I've not won that. But I will work on you all separately.
But okay, let's go back to what you were trying to talk about. What was the difference, the parallel conversations?
You know, once upon a time, there were these bridge blogs. There was a whole industry of bridge blogs. You know, you had Roland Sung writing ESWN. You had Jeremy, you had you writing
something
Danway,
called Danway.org.
Danway.org. I mean, that was our first purpose, was to translate Chinese writings that weren't appearing in English.
I still see Ma Tianjie's blog, Public Opinion. I think he does a very good job of this, of keeping people current in the conversation. Where are we? I mean, surely there's more than fucking China smack to look at to figure out what Chinese people are.
Really, well, there's plenty now.
I should just say, I'm conscious of my students sitting here. It's a shame. Jeremy here, I mean, I'd hate to get sentimental about this, but, you know, that blog was an amazing breakthrough because precisely what Jeremy, what Alice, what Joel Martinson did was to take the Chinese, discourse, you know, the Beijing Wan Bao and the things that ordinary people Chinese read and put that in English so we could, it gave us a window onto what ordinary Chinese people were thinking, reading, talking about. And we sort of take that for granted now because that's out there. There are many things like that now. And you know, you have Google Translate. I mean, it's easier to get into that world.
Baidu Translate.
Baidu, sorry. Yeah. I forgot. We have a Baidu guy here, right? Oops. But back then, you know, when you go back and look at those articles, they were amazingly well done. They were very helpful, and it sort of trained to me as someone who, you know, every morning woke up with Danway.org, It's sort of...
You did? What was Dan Lake on home doing
waking up? I always say I used to wake up with Joel Martinson. That sounds even worse, but right? But no, it was...
Contemplating waking up with Alice Jean Leo.
Yeah, now can wake up with both of them, you know. But anyway, sorry, can we cut that from the podcast? Yeah. Maybe it'll break all. Feng shui. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, I want to... because you know, all three of us are married to Chinese women, to Beijingers. You know, so the Beijingers themselves are another one. You know, the great draw of this city with their potty mouth poetry and their, I mean, that gargling R sound. Like it's every day is Talk Like a Pirate Day here in Beijing. It's a marvelous thing. Let's talk about them. I mean, I would dare say, I mean, it's the personality of the Beijing that keeps us here or makes us just love the place as much as we do. You know, rhapsodized, baby. I mean, come on. What is it that we love about our Beijingers?
You want to start?
I'm asking you.
One of the things. This was my trivia question. If anyone can name the four core values of Beijing that are up all around the city, do you remember what those are? Can anyone do it?
Aiguo.
Patriotism, innovation, inclusiveness.
Changxin.
Baorong. And what was the other one?
Anyway,
Gongde. So now if you look at Beijing, do Beijingers have Gongde? No. I mean, you yourself just spit off the railing just a few minutes ago when we were out there, you know, having a cigarette.
I was nervous.
No gongde whatsoever. You spit over the railing. I can now announce
you
that.
You were being asked about the charms of Beijing.
I know. Okay. I just want to bash. Kind of. Okay. So it's not gongde, right? It's not aiguo. Beijingers aiguo? They're the most cynical people about their country. Changxin, I don't know, maybe a little bit. Okay, well. But the thing I think is Baorong. It is so easy. It's always been that way. Still to this day, it's so easy to get into a Beijing scene, a Beijing group of writers, of intellectuals, whatever. They're totally accepting of outsiders. They do not judge. They do not feel superior. They are welcoming, opening. You know, they're very open. More so in the past maybe than now, but that's a function of just the modern society. But that's something I really love about Beijingers, is it doesn't matter what class they are, it doesn't matter if they're intellectuals, it doesn't matter if they're taxi cab drivers or the Fuyuan in my building, they will relate to you and talk with you and open up with you. They're fantastic.
But has that changed in the time that you've been here?
I said a little bit, but I don't think it's a function of Beijingers. I think it's a function of modern society where we're all looking
WeChat.
At screens like you're looking at right now, you know. WeChat world, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, but in not just in the last decade, I mean, we can go further back, but, you know, the balance between the foreign residents of Beijing and the Beijingers themselves, that dynamic has, to my mind, my way of thinking, quite appreciably changed. Jeremy, do you think that's the case?
Yeah, well, we used to be something special because we were foreigners, and now nobody gives a shit, which, you know, I think, you know, can be a bit weird when you're kind of used to people being, oh, you know, you say, xie xie, and people are like, oh, your Chinese is so good. Yeah. And now people are like, but in many ways I prefer that I'm just like some dude, you know. I'm not like, nobody cares that I can speak a bit of Chinese, you know.
That's a change. That is a change, you know, since the 80s.
I kind of like that, actually.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, in Beijing you still sometimes do encounter people, you know, you say ni hao and they're like, ooh, your Chinese is so good, and I'm just like, oh no, go, you know, go back to Henan.
You remember when...
sorry, Kaz.
No, it's Henan. For your information, my ancestral homeland is Henan. And it's the blood of every fucking joke. It's really not cool, man. Well, the place
Henan.
It's the size of the state of Missouri, and there's like the population of fucking Germany living there, and they're like, you know, cheek by jowl by somebody else's ass cheeks, and it's not.
Doesn't make for civilized living.
No, okay, but that is the cradle of Chinese civilization. But I was saying, do you remember when it used to be that we foreign types were rich?
Yes, I do.
I mean, that whole dynamic has changed quite
a bit. Yeah, I do that. Yeah, I do. It's just,
I remember not too long ago, or it was a few years ago, Jeremy and I got interviewed by this popular radio program in America, and the bumper that they had for the show, they never actually aired it on the show. It was a scene in which I was walking around the parking garage with the producer and the interviewer, just sort of naming the cars. That's a Maserati, that's Lamborghini, that's a Rolls Royce, that's a BMW 700 series, and that's my electric scooter. it was like that. I mean, and it sort of feels that way these days. It's like, you know, it's changed the dating dynamic. It's changed, you know, a lot of things in China. Just the free availability of international travel that has
right.
really changed things.
It's, yeah. I had an interesting experience. Actually, I'm not married to a Beijinger.
She's a Hebei.
She's a Hebei, almost. But so I'm Hebei is sort of my province in law, you know. And so, but my in laws, my wife's two sisters and their family, I've seen them really rise to the Xi Jinping, you know, or the Chinese goal of the Xiaokang. Shohui, right? There's a middle comfortably well off. They're driving cars. They all bought apartments. They're doing really well. They come and they're cool with money. They're not rich, but they're happy. They're safe. My father-in-law just had a heart surgery, and the government paid for it all. Eventually, we had to pay it out of pocket and up front, but then they paid for it. So they're sort of happy. And then I talked to my landlady, who's like immigrated to. Samla. Then I talked to my landlady who's like immigrated to Australia, and she owns like 6 or 7 apartments in Beijing. So she's not only a millionaire, she's probably a 10 millionaire. And she's panicked. She's saying, oh my God, what are we going to do? Oh, we're going to sell these houses. Oh, we got to get out of here. Oh, the economy's collapsing. Oh, what are we going to do? She's scared shitless. And she's a multi-millionaire, and my wife's family is like, oh, I'm happy.
It's she's like things painting a target on the bitch's back.
Right? But it's true. I mean, it's true. Right? It's weird.
It's not just
weird.
The wealth thing, though, but it's also like this knowledge gap, right? This there used to be a sort of information asymmetry going on here, where we came here, we were the foreign specialists, you know, we knew.
We could bring clothes and tapes, cassette tapes, CDs. You knew stuff about the world,
you know,
yeah.
You were able to instruct people in the intricacies of jazz.
Sure.
I was able to tell people about the less intricate intricacies of heavy metal.
Those information asymmetries are... gone.
It's largely gone. I mean, it's
despite
it's
the
gone.
You know censorship.
Really gone. It's gone the opposite direction.
You know, I mean, I know many people have spoken about a great tilt that's happened because you know we'll focus on this decade. You know, this decade encompasses what perhaps historians will see as the pivotal moment of change. The year that I'm talking about is the year 2008. And I think it's a significant fact that the closing ceremony of the 2008 Summer Games was a mere 3 weeks before what? The collapse of Bear Stearns. I mean, so as Beijing was sort of swaggering in its triumphalism, we saw at the same time just the beginnings of a full-blown, well, you know, of declinism kind of overtake the American psyche. That's changed a bit, of course, but, you know, U.S. American and European countries felt... that maybe there was really truly a new power rising in the world. How have we, as foreign nationals living in China, experienced that shift?
Well, this big shift from being a quasi third world country, right? They always call themselves a 发展中国家, right?
Or
developing country. It's been gratifying to me as someone who is, maybe I've been here so long I've got Stockholm syndrome, you know, or something. But I'm like rooting for them, and you've certainly heard in the 80s and 90s, Jeremy and everything. People they say, how do you like China? Oh, I love Beijing. And they say, no, we suck. Our country's down, you know, in the toilet. There's nothing good at all about us. They said, no, I like it. No, it's terrible. And they had this feeling of, you know, patriotism, but a sense of inferiority. It's like something wrong with us. And now I hear that less and less, except among the 1% assholes who want to get out and, you know, immigrate, but everyone who's here, there's, you don't have this instinctive feeling of, the, you know, we suck, we're horrible. And it's because the whole entire mood of the country, they just look at the, they look at the economy. Look at right now, today, Xi Jinping in Seattle and in the United States, the dynamics have totally changed. China is strong. It, you know, it hasn't, it still has lots of problems, but Xi Jinping comes there as more or less a global power equal. He's addressing the UN Assembly. And that has to do something to the psyche of the Chinese people. I've seen that turn 180 degrees since the 1980s. It's amazing. It's one of the biggest changes I've felt since coming here.
But it's weird because, I mean, I feel like it hasn't settled nicely into something. You go between these sort of this manifest inferiority complex to this kind of really quite unattractive swagger, and it hasn't settled into that comfortable confidence that should be, you know, somewhere in between. Maybe it will. Maybe the pendulous thing will be as
I think there are also still a lot of doubts in the confidence. I mean, you know, Xi Jinping's daughter went to Harvard, not Beida, you know. Just let me finish. You know, as do a lot of people. A pragmatic choice, yes, but why the pragmatic choice? Because the confidence in the home university isn't there. Why are people so keen still on buying, you know, the Yuan Zhuang, like products from overseas?
Right.
You know, people go, their friend is in America or in Europe or whatever, and they want the product that is from there, not even the same thing that is available here. You know, you go to the Apple store there, it's sort of iPhone, but people still want something bought abroad because they think something goes wrong here somehow with a lot of stuff. And I don't think that's completely gone away despite the swagger. So I think it's a very interesting mix of
You know those Apple products are actually manufactured in China.
Yes, I know, but people don't trust stuff that's like, they trust stuff that's sold abroad. Much more, and this is a generalization,
right.
But it's a very accurate generalization. Many people feel this way.
Right.
So it's a very mixed up kind of sentiment towards the country, I think.
It is. But I think if you look at opinion polls and you look at what people say, I think there are these problems, and there's still a lot that they see the wrong with their own country. I think it's a trajectory issue. I mean, they're looking long term. It's sort of like when you ask people, do you think your future will be better than that of your children? You know, I think you get a resounding yes here, and in the U.S. it's flipped. I think in the U.S. you're going to get not a resounding, but you're going to get a sigh or something. Right?
That's true.
The difference.
That is difference. Although it'll be interesting to see in the next few years, you know, if the economy slows down a bit, if that continues to be the case. And on the other hand, I find in the U.S. you know, I mean, particularly like watching Republican debates, I'm like, these people think these things that are wrong with the country and the declinism. I'm like, you have no idea like how nice things are here for most people. It's like, there are problems, but it's really...
He's still
like,
in his honeymoon period.
There are a lot of problems, but like a lot of people have a really, really nice life. A lot of people.
When my brother came here, I took him to Hohai and he took a look at it and said, ah, so this is the oppression of the Chinese people. You know, you go to Hohai and it's couples. I mean, it's like idyllic. It's amazing. You know, that's a part of Beijing that most people don't think about when they think of Beijing.
Right. That was a non sequitur, David.
I said they live a nice life. You should go to Hohai with a date sometime.
let's take it back to the question of change, which is what I really want to like focus on. I mean, it's just interesting to me to look at this little minority population of which many of us here tonight are a part, and think about how differently we handle change as compared to our Chinese friends. I mean, I am a guy who, in living memory, this is in the late 90s, was sitting there on a sunny San Lincoln afternoon drinking some, you know, drink with, you know, I think it was a mojito or something, and saying to my friend, one of the things that I really like about this place is the slow pace of life. And now, you know, everybody walks faster than me. I get in the elevator and everyone is like following each other, pushing up the close the elevator button. Everyone is in such a damn hurry. And I haven't really sped up that much. I mean, part of it is I'm getting, you know, old and feeble. But that is, I mean, it's a remarkable acceleration that we've experienced. And have we kept up? Have we really kept up? Are we, you know, I mean, this is a phenomenal transformation of society. It's a psychological one. It's a physical one. It's an infrastructural one. I mean, it's happening across a broad spectrum of China. This is the country where the rubber hits the road on globalization. This is the country that has benefited the most from globalization. This is the country that has suffered the most from globalization, from its excesses. So, you know, the good sides, you know, the job creation, the infrastructure, the all of these things that have happened. But then the bad, the environmental degradation, the wealth inequality, all of these things. It's good and bad. I need to see how the story ends. I need to be here to see that. But the thing that always impresses me is just the much greater capacity of my Chinese friends to absorb change.
I couldn't agree with that more. I think that to me is one of the most kind of impenetrable, but in a way admirable things about Chinese people.
And this is so paradoxical, because I can say to you with a very straight face that there are no people on earth who are more freighted by their history, who carry around more historical luggage than the Chinese, who feel more inertia and inability to change because of history. I can believe that, and in the same moment believe there's nobody on this planet who's capable of changing faster, changing on a dime faster.
Yeah.
I mean, how can both of these things be true? And yet they are.
Yeah. I don't know how to explain it. There's almost a psychological thing I've seen at every level, even among some of my friends. After the 89 incident, some of my Peking University friends were able to make it out and go to Indiana University. And the first night they were there, I loaned them my bike, and they were riding across the campus. And I said, "So how did you feel the first night in the United States?" And they said, "Oh, I felt I was pretty much at Peking University. It's pretty much the same." I said, "What? I mean, it took me 10 years to feel at home in China. I mean, and these people felt at home almost overnight. And if you think about it, there are people in living memory, probably some people here tonight, who went through, a Mao period, saw, you know, a Red Guard period, a Cultural Revolution period, saw Deng's reform and opening up, saw Confucius vilified, banned, hated, and now seeing him brought back. They've seen 180-degree changes and utterly different situations. And people just say, they open another subway line. Oh, okay, Three Gorges Dam. That's a big dam, yeah.
South North Water Diversion Project. How did that happen without the kind of fanfare?
There's no fanfare for these things. People take it in stride. And also big changes like the advent of digital technology, the advent, you know, there was a youth culture after all that sprang up in the 80s and in the 90s. If this were the United States, there'd be books written about it. People would be wondering, you know, how is this going to affect our lives and our generation? What's the psychological problems of growing up? They just take it in stride and move forward. And there's something I can't quite, as an American, I can't quite understand that. But it's also.
But I think that's
amazing.
Part of the problem as an American for you, because I mean, people in other countries, things are fucked up, right? Like my own home country of South Africa. I mean, I grew up in apartheid South Africa. The day before I started university, Nelson Mandela was let out of prison. 4 years later, we had an actual democratic election, and everything was completely different, you know. And now,
how did they take it?
But aren't we, as Americans, supposed to be the ones who are the agents of change, for whom you know, constant change is here to stay?
I don't think that describes actually America. I mean, it does. It's a land of innovation for sure. But I mean, people's lives don't change. I mean, history hasn't really affected people in America like it has in China or South Africa or many parts of the world since the Civil War. Really, I mean, you don't have this sudden, like, complete realignment of the whole social, economic, and political, you know, sphere in America. I mean, that hasn't happened since the Civil War.
But what Jeremy's saying is that we Americans are spoiled, pampered wussies.
Yeah, that's right.
Who live in a pampered environment. Yeah, and we go, oh my God, you know, like.
Kind of.
So, look at China.
Speaking of change, is it possible to get another beer? Because this podcast I find very difficult to do without sufficient supply.
Adequate lubrication. So, I mean, as you wait your beer, answer this question for me. We tend to parcel things out into decades, and we're here to observe the 10-year anniversary of the bookworm in this location. So 2015 to 2005, 2005 to 1995, 95 to 85, 85 to 75, we've seen part of all of that. What decade actually saw the most profound changes? Jeremy?
Well, I mean, I think in some ways one would have to say, you know, after Mao's death, reform and opening up, so the very, you know, the early 80s.
Yeah, so it's the 80s, right? I think it
but
really
in terms of this city, I don't know. Yeah, I think it must be the early 80s. I mean, that's when things really did.
That's when the aspect in people's eyes changed, right?
And
that's
I agree with you, but I think
people switched on, right?
That's right. But I think it was a truncated change. I think that there was a trajectory that was broken at 1989, and then you went back to something else in the 1990s.
Three
I think
years,
was,
right?
Yeah, maybe. I think we're still there. I mean, after all, I mean, you know, we haven't returned even to the levels we were in some cases before 1989. But I think
that was a rarefied set of intellectuals in
right,
Beida, I mean,
right,
yeah,
right. That was a sort of an opening up. I would point to the opening of the digital age.
That too, sure.
Yeah, when you first started getting bootleg DVDs, and then the next one would be, you know, now where we are with
yeah,
the internet.
Yeah.
Those three are just enormous.
And then physically, I mean, if you're talking about Beijing itself, not China, physically, I would say it would be, you know, 2001 to 2008 from the time
from
they
the
announced.
The moment that the announcement.
You know, and then suddenly there was like a million more cranes in Beijing.
It also
and,
felt like
you know.
That's when China stopped having a sort of human scale. I mean, it was never entirely human scale. It was ridiculously rectilinear, and there were, you know, these
right.
Absurdly broad boulevards, of course. But the sort of enormous, the outside.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that so much.
That happened, you know, between
yeah.
2001.
For my students who are here,
are you drinking this way?
Yeah, you can have it, man.
Oh, thanks.
They haven't seen the old Beijing. I mean, the Hutong and everything. Beijing was always thought of as a very humanistic, or what's the word, human-centered city. It was very ecological. The Hutongs themselves, you know, were very feng shui, you know, paradigms. And you go down Chang'an Boulevard now, and you go to this CCTV building and everything, and it's almost purposely designed to make you lose track of scale and human, you know, proportions. It's like that's the whole purpose of it is to wow you. I found it almost like a sort of new the same ethos or the same aesthetic in which Tiananmen Square was built with the huge hall, the great hall of the people and the
right,
history.
The desire to impress
with the state power. And I see the CCTV building as another extension of that. Hmm. With the addition that at least the Great Hall of the People all looks okay now. It's obviously very sort of hybrid Russian. The CCTV building, do you think that's going to look good in 50 years? It looks ridiculous now.
You know,
no, it doesn't. It's one of my favorite buildings in the whole world. It's
yeah,
it's beautiful.
Yeah.
No.
And so I
end then you jump off of it.
Before we move to recommendations, one last question for you guys. You guys, I mean, we've been here for an awfully long time, you know, 6 years between us or more. How do you get that fix when you just got a strong Jones for nostalgia in Beijing? Where do you go to bring yourself back? What do you do when you need to just like get that nostalgia kick?
That's easy. I go right around the corner into one of the little Hutong areas that still exist on the Qianlong map.
That ping pong place, but near your place, near your.
And almost any of them. You just go to any restaurant in the back alley there, and they'll come in and they'll plop a menu down that's got 100 items, and you sit there with peanuts and, you know, jiaochuan cai, and I'm back in the Beijing exactly of the not of the 80s, probably of before that. I mean that's I think that's the kind of thing I'm going to miss the most if I ever leave is that culture.
So if you guys have a Jones for this, I would recommend the. The Yanfeng Shichang. You guys ever been to the Yanfeng Shichang? It's like it's retro. It's near the Carrefour. If you go just straight south from the Carrefour near the old convention center, by the Jing'an Dasha. There's this crazy old place where, you know, it's the ground floor is kind of a wet and dry market, and then the second floor and the third floor above it just have like this stuff that. It's the 80s. It's suddenly you're back in the 80s. It's all those brands that you've never see anymore. Like you know, back when branding consisted of name of animal and color. So it's like white, you know, white cat or black, you know, whatever, goldfish. Everything was named that way.
Right,
white
true.
Elephant batteries.
That's true. White rabbit.
Right, white rabbit. Exactly. And everything was like, and it there's these delightfully surly waitress. I mean, you know, serve people in these like hideous blue polyester outfits. And they're just surly and it's awesome.
You're nostalgic for that.
I am. I'm my sexual fantasies involve being abused by women like this.
Uh oh. Feng shui.
Hey, you got a nostalgia kick for us?
Oh, I don't know. I used to find the Friendship Store actually this kind of weird nostalgia kick because. It just, you know, I mean, there's no reason for it to exist anymore. The store opened because, you know, whenever it was in the 60s, I guess, you couldn't get any stuff, you know, foreign products, and only foreigners were allowed into it. In fact, before I was
and you had to use FEC,
foreign exchange certificates.
Right.
And
these people don't know FEC.
It's this kind of weird feeling of like a China that just doesn't exist anymore. I mean, there's no reason for a Friendship Store. You get much better products
no
at any Chinese department store. And I used to quite like going in there sometimes just to remind myself of how much things have changed.
Well, cool. You know what? I mean, the signal for you guys to start coming up to the mic if you've got questions is we're moving into our recommendations section now. As is our custom, let us start with Jimmy, Mr. Jeremy.
All right, I've got a very sort of non-intellectual type of recommendation today, which is the first time since 1995 that I've stayed in a hotel in Beijing. And there's a hotel on Chunxiulu, the Holiday Inn Express, and it's just a nice place to stay. If you ever need to recommend a hotel to somebody coming into town, if the first time visit to Beijing, maybe put them up in a hutong. But if it's the second visit to Beijing, it's just a great area.
It's close to the Great Leap. You're just really
no, I don't like the Great Leap. I hate craft beer. beer should be swilled, not taste
chewed.
Like it's not whiskey or wine. Anyway, a very kind of vibey, good street life, and you know, pedestrian area, which a lot of hotels in Beijing, you walk out the front door and you can't walk, and this one is nice. And it's close to the Book Wall. Very close to good Sichuan food, a number of good Sichuan restaurants.
And right near my home too.
All right, David, what do you got for us? So Jeremy recommends a Holiday Inn Express.
Isn't that great, huh? Okay. And I unrecommend craft beer.
Ben, you can just strike that off.
Right. So I taught Jeremy talking to the manager of that hotel just before he came over, so yeah. I have something to do with it.
He's been confident.
He's staying there for free the next 3 days.
You dog.
So I want to recommend an article in The Atlantic by Benjamin Carlson called The World According to Xi Jinping. And the reason I like it is because I've had Xi Jinping's book on my office desk for like a half a year now, and I've never been able to get into it and read it. And
can't imagine why.
It's there, and you know, I think I should read some of this, but I just read it. And Ben Carlson has done it for us. He's read the whole thing from beginning to end, and he summarizes it and tells what's in the book. And yes, it is boring, but it's meta interesting in a lot of ways. One of the interesting things is he says the United States hardly appears in it at all. It's only mentioned like once, less than Saudi Arabia and lots of other countries. And the impression one gets is that the United States is not that important. It doesn't figure in Xi Jinping's view of the future, which is very interesting. Anyway, so for those of you who don't want to read his book but want to know what's in it, that's the article to read. This is too weird.
I don't know if you guys read the Nigerian writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Anyone read her?
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, like, seriously. Wow. Her new novel, Americana, is just fantastic, and I highly recommend it. It's treatment of, you know, the immigrant and expatriate. I'm going to use this with her because, you know, of Nigerians in America, the relationship between African Americans and American Africans in America, which she writes on just with incredible insight, impressions, and humor. Nigerians in England, Nigerians returnees in Lagos, And the thing was that for some reason I kept reading it, there were definite parallels to me, not always real similarities between the equivalent, you know, Chinese experiences. It's just a book with a ton of heart and a wonderful love story, and it's just full of really well-developed characters and some brilliant, brilliant prose. I shed a tear. I mean, when I finished that book, I was just moved. Highly recommend it. Okay. I see you've read this and you liked it too, right? Yeah, oh, good, good, good. We'll talk. Also, on the theme of living in a country other than your native country, which is what we've been talking about, Matthew Sheehan, Matt, of the Huffington Post, who is easily one of my favorite young writers working in China today.
And he's been on the podcast twice.
Yeah, he's been
twice.
Actually, we're going to run his hip-hop one pretty soon.
Cool.
He's done it again with a truly wonderful piece on College Daily. How many of you know about College Daily? I see somebody in the back there. The lifer guy, I think.
No.
Cool. Anyway, China College Daily, not China Daily, is an online digital platform, you know, that's distributed mainly through Weixin and WeChat about college life and about issues that Chinese people face living in America. It's got some, you know, 400,000 subscribers. College students are all reading this, and it's genius. You know, he's a terrific profile on these people. It's titled "Here's What All the Chinese Students at Your School Are Reading," and it's great. It's a good piece, and I subscribed to it now, and it's really fun to read. To read, you know, like their take on, you know, beer pong or whatever. No, but on dating, it's like on Tinder. It's just great stuff. Anyway, I want to thank you all.